Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're going to start our program today by talking with you about beer. Larry Mueller here. I serve beer at many family functions. You probably serve it as well, or you may serve it as well. Maybe you have it around the table. You have it at football games or whatever. It's beer is a part of our Wisconsin history. And we have seen just in recent years a huge increase in craft beers here in the state. I think we have somewhere around 85 craft breweries now in Wisconsin. But we've also seen an increase in people wanting to make their own beer. And Randy Mosher is knows all about making home beer. He's the author of Mastering Home Brew. He's also the home brewing columnist in All About Beer, a regular contributor to the Journal of the American Home Brewers Association, and a frequent lecturer on beer. He goes across the country doing lectures. Also on the board of directors of the American Home Brewers Association and the Chicago Beer Society. And Randy, great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for taking time.
Yeah, great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
You've spent a little time in Wisconsin, I bet.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It's a great place for beer, for sure, with a lot of good craft beers, as I mentioned. And also now a lot of homebrews and homebrewing going on. And I think homebrewing has increased, has it not, across the country?
Yeah, I think the current estimates are somewhere between 4 and 6 million homebrewers currently.
That's an amazing number. How did you get started in it?
Just was interested in beer. I went to college in Cincinnati, and at the time there were 4 local breweries still hanging on, older breweries. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I had this idea that there was some variety around. It wasn't just Budweiser and Miller and Coors, and after talking about it and really getting interested in food and cooking, a friend and I just stopped talking about it and ordered a kit and started making beer.
And your advertising background, you came from an advertising background. I actually think that probably came into play with your book, because you got some nice graphics and so forth in your book.
Yeah, I'm a total pain in the butt to publishers, because I'm also a designer, so I have definite ideas about what I like and what I don't like. So it makes it extra challenging. But in the end, we get a better book out of it.
So. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have questions. Are you a home brewer or just interested in the whole process of it? Maybe you'd like to give it a try. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear your experiences as well. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments there. So we'd certainly love to hear from you. And maybe to begin with, describe how you've got your book organized here, because I think you've done a good job with that.
Well, there's a lot of different stages to brewing, and the book more or less follows the stages of brewing. I start with a little bit of introduction and a bit of just general information about flavor and tasting, which is really crucial as your foundation for brewing, because you can brew no better than you can taste. So that's important. So there's some discussion of some of the basics, some of the scientific basics, things like pH and what an ion is, and some really basic science that you need to understand a little bit in order to grasp what's really going on in your brew. And then there's a big chapter on ingredients. I think it's the biggest chapter in the book that really goes into a lot of detail about the different kinds of malts and what the flavors are and how they got there, because really, understanding flavor is key to understanding beer. And so, you know, as a brewer, you have all these choices to make as far as what to put in, what techniques to use, which yeast to ferment with. And if you understand the how the flavor got there in those ingredients, it helps you understand the landscape a lot better. So there's a big section on malts and other grains. There's a big section on hops, where I try and organize about 70 different varieties of hops to help people understand what the relationships are, and when they can't get one, what they might want to go for next, or how to branch out and try things beyond what they're comfortable trying. And then some spices and other herbs and fruits, things like that. Then it goes into equipment, technique, eventually get to yeast, and then there's a very big chapter on recipe formulation, because that's sort of the soul of this book, is trying to help people understand, how do you build a recipe? You know, if you're a band, do you want to be a cover band, or do you want to do original music? And so that's the analogy for brewing, and I think everybody who gets beyond the basics, they ought to be thinking about what they want to brew, and not just cloning commercial beers or copying other people's recipes.
Yeah, those are very good points. Let's go to simple terms, though, in basic terms. Can you describe how to brew your first beer?
Yeah, you go to the homebrew shop, you pick up a kit for somewhere between $100 and $200, come home to your kitchen, put a pot of water on the stove, heat it up. During that time, you're going to put some crushed grains, some special color flavor malts in a bag, like a giant tea bag, heat that water up, extract some color and flavor. Once that comes to a boil, you pull that out and you add malt extract, which is either a powder or a liquid. It basically saves you a few hours of work, and it's how everybody gets started. Although, you know, you don't need to do that. You can actually go to a more complicated thing, but generally people start with the extract. You bring it to a boil, you add some hops. Maybe you add some more hops. Maybe you add some more hops. Maybe you add more hops. Depends on what you want. At the end of the process, you turn off the heat, you cool it down, you get some air in there as best you can, and then add some yeast and put it in a big glass jug called a carboy or plastic bucket designed for fermentation, and you let it rip, and it'll go crazy for 3 or 4 days and then settle down. Then there's a slower period called conditioning, where the yeast absorbs some of the off flavors that it's made in its haste to consume sugars. And then eventually you add a little bit more. You move it over to another vessel. You add a little bit of sugar to it to give the yeast a little more food, so that when you put it in a bottle and put the cap on, the yeast goes into fermentation mode again, and it creates a little carbon dioxide gas, which gives you your carbonation. Wait, chill, and drink.
and there you go.
There you go.
Well,
yeah.
Thanks for being with us today, Randy. That was
great. My pleasure.
No, there's a whole lot more to it that we want to talk about with him as we go along today. Randy Mosher, our guest, he's the author of Mastering Home Brew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. And a caller, Emily, couldn't hang on from Stevens Point, but wondered, and this perfect question, perfect timing on it, when you're making beer, how can you make the beer smell less pungent when home brewing?
Oh, during home brewing?
Yeah, I think it's. I think she means during. Yeah, during the process, you get a very pungent aroma. How do you? Is there any way to tamp that down? Let's put it.
Well, I think a lot of people brew outside or brew in a garage.
Yeah.
So that solves that problem. You know, basically, what's happening is that there are some fairly harsh components in the hops that you really want to boil away. And if you can boil very gently and slowly, and you don't get the smell as much, but they're going to stay in your beer. And I'd rather have them in the kitchen and blow them out with the vent fan than have them linger along in my beer. So you're trying to remove some of those really volatile compounds. So I'd say, you know, a bigger vent fan would be in order at their house.
Yeah, or outside for sure.
Yeah, or outside.
And how would you define, well, here I was talking earlier about craft breweries. Do you have a definition of craft brewery?
Well, you know, the Brewers Association does, and it kind of has to do with who owns it and how big they are. It's always a little tricky. It's one of those things that you know it when you see it, but it's hard to put your finger on. It's really hard to define craft beer. My definition is, if the guys at the brewery who are brewing the beer have a say in what the beer tastes like, it's craft beer. if it comes from a marketing department based on market research, and then the brand, you know, the brand manager hands a description to the brewmaster and say, people want this beer, make this beer, that's not craft beer.
And, you know, it's interesting that so many, I think, home brewers, we have so many craft breweries now here in Wisconsin that have just come in the last 5 years.
Oh, it's crazy everywhere. I was just in Mexico for Cerveza Mexico, and it's the same thing just starting to happen down there. And lots of people want to get in the business. And it's really cool because, I mean, I always say it's really great that a whole bunch of people that have no idea what they're doing are getting into the business. Because they're driven by passion, they're driven by, like, they just feel like they have to do it. You know, and some of them will succeed and some of them won't, and that's okay. But there's just this passion everywhere, really around the world now. People are doing it not because it's a great business opportunity, because it's something they feel like they want to do with their life.
And I think a lot of them got their, probably I bet most of them got their start as homebrewers.
Almost all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rare, it's a rare brewery that doesn't have a home brewer at the core. I mean, Sierra Nevada, Ken Grossman of Sierra Nevada, he started brewing when he was 14 in his closet. And his mother was wise enough to let him continue because, you know, she saw something in him that resonated with, and of course he started, you know, one of the more important craft breweries, and early, you know, that was in I think 1978 something.
He'd made a buck or two on it.
He's done very well, but it's taken, you know, really 40 years.
Yeah, overnight sensation 40 years later.
Exactly.
Larry in Wheeler has a question. Larry, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I like lagers, but what is the very easiest type of brew to make?
Well, here's what I would recommend. Would be to make an ale, but try and keep the temperature as low as you can. Because the distinction between a lager and an ale really has to do with how warm it's fermented. And at higher temperatures, you get more fruitiness. So you could basically take a Pilsner recipe, ferment it with a nice, clean English ale yeast, and kind of manage the temperature, keep that about at the low end of that yeast temperature range, and you'll produce a beer that's a lot like lager. You know, lagers do require, they ferment slower. You really have to ferment them in a refrigerator because you need to get that temperature very low. So anytime you try and make one of those beers, even if it's a cool fermented ale, you want to make sure that you have some temperature control. A lot of people use a chest freezer and put a thermostat on that. That's a pretty typical homebrew device. Just throw that out in the garage or the basement and set it and do your beer in there.
There you go. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for calling. Someone told me that a lager is maybe the hardest beer to brew successfully.
Well, I think certainly those pale lagers that mass market brewers make with adjuncts in them, because the beers are very delicate, very pale, they don't have a lot of flavor to them. So any kind of off flavor, any raspiness, any weird aroma, it's going to punch right through that. And so I think most of the people, they may not always like the marketing techniques of the big brewers, but people in the craft brewing business have a lot of respect for what they're able to do around the world to make a beer very consistent, batch to batch and brewery to brewery. So those are very challenging beers to make.
Yeah, they sure would be. Paul in Madison, I think, up next with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Paul. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, guys. Good program here today.
Thank you.
Hey, I've been home brewing since the mid-80s kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And I've got a question. So in recipe formulation, is there any reference to some of the old, original German-American beers, like Pabst Blue Ribbon? What was the beer that actually won the Blue Ribbon? I mean, the current stuff is not going to be a Blue Ribbon winner. How could we find that out and brew it at home?
Well, here's what I would suggest. I don't know that anybody's got the actual Pabst recipe, but it's my understanding that a lot of those brews, then as now, were brewed fairly similarly. They tended to have somewhere between 15 and 25% of either corn grits or rice in it. You could use a flaked product as well. Pabst was definitely a corn beer. Anheuser-Busch Budweiser was a rice beer. So, but you want to look up a thing called pre-prohibition beer, and there's been a lot of interest in that over the last 10 years or so, and people have dug up old recipes, and you know, they generally have more hops than the current crop of beers. I'd say, I think Budweiser has about 12 bitterness units, and most people feel that these old pre-pro lagers were somewhere between 25 and 35, maybe even a little bit higher, and a little bit less adjunct than current beers, so they have a little bit more rich, malty mouthfeel to them. And they generally seem to have a little bit more color. I've collected a lot of old photographs of people drinking beer, and they weren't quite as ghostly pale 100 years ago as they are today. So I'd use a little bit of crystal malt maybe, or a hint of Munich or Vienna to give you a little bit of a golden shimmer to it. And I think those three things. And then also you want to look at your hops too. Typically they use the hop called a cluster for bittering, and then often used Sots or Hallertau, some of the classic noble hops, for aroma on the premium beers especially.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today about mastering homebrew, and got some craft breweries discussion going a little bit as well with our guest, Randy Mosher, who is the author of the book we're talking about today. It's called Mastering Homebrew, Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking about mastering home brew with our guest, Randy Mosher. And again, you can call in at 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. You talk about, and before we go back to the phones, early in the book, I don't know, where I think maybe in the 30s, you talk about the anatomy of beer, page 32 or 3, I think, and how knowing beer anatomy can help you be a better brewer. Can you explain that concept?
Well, you know, you need to understand the way beer is described and measured in terms of its alcohol content, its color, its bitterness, its attenuation, which is a measure of how completely the sugars have been fermented out in a beer. And that will help you get an idea of the general characteristics of it. And then beyond that, really one of the things that everybody who's in the beer business or the homebrew hobby needs to really work on all the time is their vocabulary and their tasting skills. And beer has at least 1,000 ingredients, maybe good deal more than that. Nobody seems to be actually keeping the list. But it's more than twice as many compounds as in wine. And so we have a lot of different flavors that we need to identify. We don't need to learn all 1,000, but we, you know, everybody in the business or in the hobby needs to know a couple of dozen pretty characteristic aromas and learn to look for them, learn to be able to identify them, learn that technique for tasting, because it's super, super important to being able to control the recipe and evaluate your beer at the end to determine, is it good? Is it bad? Does it have a problem? If so, what's the problem? And then once you know what the problem is, then you be able to take steps to fix it.
Yeah, makes good sense. Joe in Spooner has a question. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Randy. I have a question for you about brewing India Pale Ales or IPAs.
Mm-hmm.
I've been home brewing for about 5 years, and I consider myself intermediate. I all-grain brew. By all my ingredients bulk, and even grow some of my own hops. I can brew really good dark ales of various sorts, but my favorite beer, and much of my friends' favorite beer, is IPA. And I can get bitter with an IPA, but I can't seem to capture that really fresh flavor and aroma that you can get with a commercial beer. When I crack one open and pour it in, I can smell it, I can taste it. But my home brews just don't have that same fresh, bitter taste and aroma. Any suggestions on how to improve that?
Yeah, probably a few. Are you dry hopping?
I am dry hopping.
You are dry hopping.
And what is dry hopping?
So dry hopping is basically adding hops to the fermentation.
Okay.
Normally, when you're making beer, you put some hops in at the beginning of the boil. That boiling process is going to chemically change and dissolve the bittering compounds that are in the hops, but they're also driving off aroma. So if you want aroma, too, you have to add it. In addition to adding bittering hops at the beginning, you need to add aroma hops towards the end of the boil, and then sometimes if you want a lot of aroma, even at the end. So are you using massive quantities of hops for your aroma hops?
Usually, per 5-gallon batch, usually 2 to 3 ounces.
Yeah, you could probably bump that up a little bit. One of the things that people are doing now is a technique called hop bursting. You familiar with that?
I've heard of it, but I don't remember exactly what that means.
Yeah, so basically what you're doing is in order to get a lot of aroma without just too much bitterness, what the brewers are finding is that they can't really add a lot of hops at the beginning of the boil, and they don't necessarily need to. So you can actually add just maybe a pinch of hops at the beginning, a quarter ounce or something, just so you have some tannins to help coagulate some of that protein in there, and then load up right at the very end with a ton of hops, a ton of aroma hops, you know, maybe 4 or 5 ounces, maybe more. And then you're going to get, because during that cooling down period, that wort is still hot, you're going to be picking up, getting some isomerization, meaning that you're going to get some bitterness out of those aroma hops, even though you put them in at the end. And if you do that, and you should get a good deal more aroma. And then if you're dry hopping, really heavily dry hopping, that's the other way. And I don't think there's any other magic secret sauce to it than that. It's just using ridiculous amount of hops will get you ridiculous amount of aroma. Brewers don't have any. I mean, they're using some extracts to get the bitterness these days, but in my experience dealing with aroma extracts is they always taste a little bit fakey. So I think it's just really you got to just use the hops and use a lot of them and use the good, you know, use the ones that you like. Get a hold of some of the newer hops like Mosaic and Calypso. There's a lot of really fantastic hops out there.
Yeah, and hop bursting is what I've known as late wort hopping. And I've done a bit of that. And something else I tried recently in a couple batches is, you know, once I kill the boil and I start to chill it down, I read somewhere that you can add hops when the wort reaches 170 degrees. And then let it rest until it hits about 160, and you're adding some fresh hops at that point. And I've tried that a couple times. It doesn't seem to do a whole lot. Have you heard of that technique at all?
Well, that's basically whirlpool hopping. I'm not sure I would only do it for that limited period of time. I think I would just throw it in, you know, in the last, either last 5 minutes or as soon as you turn off your burner, throw them in and let them sit until the wort's cooled. I don't see any real advantage to just having a really limited period that's going to limit the amount of stuff you're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
Not very efficient that way.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Joe, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Carol in Madison has a question. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My question was about the scalability of beer recipes. A few years back, did a little home brewing and really enjoyed it and kind of had to give it up because my arthritis as I have aged has become more acute and it's just too hard for me to get that, you know, 5 and 6 gallon bucket full of liquid up and down the stairs. So I'm wondering,
sure,
can I make a 2 gallon batch?
Oh, yes, of course. When you scale up, say, to a commercial size, you really have to make some adjustments in the recipe. You get much better hop utilization, for example, and so you know when we're going from a homebrew batch to a commercial batch, you have to make a lot of changes. But I would say a lot of people are doing two gallon batches these days, and I've heard you're not the first woman I've heard say that the 5 gallon batch is a little hard to handle. They're a little hard to handle for men, especially in those glass carboys. They're kind of scary to and quite dangerous to carry around.
Right.
So 2 gallons is a perfectly reasonable size, and you know, if you use a full package of yeast, you'll get a better fermentation than you would if you used it for 5 gallons of beer. So you know, there's absolutely no reason why you wouldn't be able to get great results. I'm actually in the process of rescaling my own brewery to do the same thing because I'm involved in commercial breweries. I don't need a lot of beer hanging around, but I am working on some historic recipes, and I need to be able to whip through a lot of different beers. So for me, a 1 or 2 gallon system is going to be the future.
And so is the in terms of the ingredients and so forth, you just cut it back proportionally?
Yeah, just cut it back proportionally. You know, everybody's system is a little different, so whatever's in my book or anybody else's book or on those computer programs that you can use, the apps for brewing, you always have to make a little bit of adjustment for your own system because every little combination of equipment and technique will affect that a little bit. So you always have to kind of take that into account no matter what system you're brewing on.
Hmm, interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carol, for calling.
Happy brewing.
Yeah, get back to brewing right now. Kurt and Poinette, your turn. Hi, Kurt. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Just a quick question about the last caller. I, too, am scaling back, and I currently have a one-gallon batch of hard cider in the making, rather than the five-gallon brewing. But my call is about gluten-free ale. I've done a couple dozen batches of regular beer over the years. I tried a gluten-free kit last year, and it uses sorghum instead of malt extract. And it just doesn't have the beer taste. Any suggestions on what I could do? Because I want to continue with a gluten-free beer.
Yeah, there's good news. Those sorghum beers are pretty awful. And really, the government actually had to make a variance on its policy to be able to actually call them beer at all. But there is an additive that's basically a clarifying agent. It's called Clarity Firm. I believe White Labs sells it. To commercial brewers, I'm not sure whether it's in the homebrew market, but I'm sure that you could find a way to get your hands on some. And you add it at the beginning of fermentation or maybe at the end of the boil, I can't remember. And what it does is it's an enzyme, and it looks for a particular amino acid called proline. And it just so happens that gluten is very, very high in proline. So when this enzyme is breaking up proline, it's actually breaking up gluten. And so we're doing this at one of my commercial breweries. It's actually used to make less haze in the beer, so it clarifies the beer a little bit, but it breaks that gluten down and gets it. I think the federal standard for gluten-free is 20 parts per million. We've had our beer tested, and it's at the limit of the test, which is 10 parts per million. So that's exceedingly low gluten. And so I think for almost everybody with gluten sensitivity, that should be well within the range of comfort. So I'd look at getting my hands on that, and basically any beer you want to brew, you can throw that stuff in, and it's going to break up the gluten for you.
Oh, it's going to make it gluten-free.
It's going to make it gluten-free, yeah.
So you're saying use the regular beer recipe, but use this additive at the...
Yeah. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, terrific. Okay.
It really basically solves the problem.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Thanks, Kurt, for calling. Appreciate your call. And what's it called again?
It's called Clarity Firm.
Clarity Firm. Okay. Because I'm sure there are a whole bunch of people saying, wait a minute, what did he say? What was that? What was that again?
Yeah.
Clarity Firm. Okay. And Jackie in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Yeah, I used to homebrew. I had to give it up during the recession, lost all my equipment. But anyway, the person looking for a lager type beer that would be easy to make. I used to make a Kolsch, and those people who love lagers but not much on ales found that the Kolsch had a nice flavor profile that they found similar to lager, and they enjoyed that. And if you take the Kolsch type yeast and ferment at a slightly lower temperature, it gives a very similar flavor profile to the lagers.
Oh.
Yeah, in fact, the Germans call Kolsch Obergärige lager beer, or top fermenting lager beer, because it is lagered, but it's a different yeast.
Yeah, different yeast.
That's an excellent suggestion, and it is. They call them hybrids because they're sort of halfway between ale and lager.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Jackie. John in Ashland, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Real quick. Anyway, I've never brewed beer before, and I was thinking of doing it this fall.
Yeah,
and I would be storing it in a root cellar, and I don't know if letting it fermenting there is also the optimal location. So that's part of the question. The other thing is, being a novice, buying just a kit from a beer making store, would that suffice, or should I get your book?
You're going to need some information. And, of course, you know, I do like my book, but there are other books, and it depends on what you're looking for. But, you know, it's the more information, the better. Most people who homebrew have a lot of books because you never seem to have enough information. So I would definitely recommend getting my book or John Palmer's book or one of Charlie Papazian's books. There's plenty of good books out there.
Yeah.
And
I do have a book from the 70s that I found at a used bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a not that much on history, but a lot of recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And they call for one ingredient, and unfortunately I'm not at home. And it starts with a V. And it's in many of the recipes, that I think it starts with D-I. And I don't know if you, that may not be enough of a clue for you.
It's an ingredient or a cleaning material?
Yeah, it's an ingredient. Yeah, add a packet of, and then it starts with a V.
And did you say B as in boy or D as in dog?
No, B as in Victor.
Oh, V. V.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not really sure what that would be.
Okay.
You know, things have changed an awful lot since the 1970s.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend getting a book that's been published within the last 10 or 15 years because it's a completely different world these days.
Yeah.
As far as your root cellar question, you generally, with most beers, you want to ferment them in somewhere in the 60s temperature range, in the middle to upper 60s. It depends a little, you know, what you're trying to do. I fermented a lot of beer in my basement, and it was uninsulated and pretty chilly at the time. And so what I did is made a little cart to put my fermenters on, and I put a 25-watt heater on the bottom and put a little simple thermostat on and made a styrofoam jacket for it. And, you know, when you have a cold location, it's really easy to warm the beer up a little bit. If you're in a warm location, trying to chill it down is a little more complicated. You really need to do it in a refrigerator or something. So I'd check your temperature down there and see where you're at. If you're in the 60s, rock on. If you're a little cooler than that, just make a really simple little heater, and you should be able to even like put a space heater down there would probably do the job.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
And your book will have plenty of recipes then in it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of recipes. The book title, by the way, I'll mention it again, is Mastering Home Brew, the subtitle, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. And, of course, our guest today, Randy Mosher, last name spelled M-O-S-H-E-R. And am I pronouncing it right? I hope I am. Mosher.
Mosher is normally what?
Yeah, Mosher.
Yeah.
So there we go. Michael in New Berlin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Well, you just talked about temperature. I'm blessed that my basement is at 65 degrees year-round, so I'm perfect for making ales.
Absolutely.
One thing I wanted to suggest, I found a program online that will work on Linux or Windows. I think it might even be a Mac version. It's called Q Brew. Like you got a Q ball,
mm-hmm.
Q Brew, and I find it's actually fairly accurate for helping predict your gravities, your bitterness. The alcohol content, it's a very good program. You can add your own things to the database if you have a different hop that you use or a different adjuvant that you use. It's a wonderful program. I wonder if you guys have heard of it.
You know, I don't know that one. I'm familiar with Beersmith. I think that's probably one of the more widely used ones out there these days. But like I said, all the programs kind of more or less do the same calculations. You always need to make some adjustment for your own system. You may get lucky and like find their calculations are exactly right for you, but another person with a different system may find they're a little high or a little low. So that's always two or three beers worth of calibrating you have to do.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Grant called and wondered the difference between the process of brewing beer versus brewing apple ales.
Well, there is no such, I mean, apple ale, I don't know. You know, there's that product on the market called Red's Apple Ale.
Yeah.
That's neither apple nor ale. My understanding, that's a flavored malt beverage, which is basically you brew a beer and then you strip everything out with carbon filtration, and then they squirt some apple flavoring back into it. So you can make beer and use apple juice along with it. It'll give the beer an incredible head, bring some acidity. You know, I've had better luck with juice concentrates than with pure juice because it tends to kind of dilute it pretty much. Crab apple juice is great if you've got a crab apple tree and some way to press them out, you get some really beautiful pink
juice and a ton of flavor, so there's a thought there. You just got to kind of get in there and experiment, and I'm sure you can find some recipes on the internet for it.
Oh, yeah. And how's your book doing, by the way? Just
doing
out,
well.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, we came out in February, and it takes a little while to build, but it's been getting good reviews, and people seem to enjoy it, and definitely a different book.
Definitely enjoying it myself, and I haven't finished the entire book, but it's certainly a great read. You're a good writer, too, so that helps. Yeah, that always helps. And I really enjoyed your I like hoppy beer.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed your chapter on hops and sort of discussion of hoppiness.
Yeah, it's a fantastic time for hops. There's a huge amount of breeding going on to develop new aroma varieties. So just every year there's a ton of new ones coming onto the market. So really, it'd be like in the wine world, every year, 10 new grapes.
There you go. There's so many other things we could talk about here. We are out of time. Thank you so much, Randy, for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Appreciate it.
Randy Mosher is the author, again, of Mastering Home Brew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. And he's got a really nice book here, and I think you're going to enjoy it. If you're somebody who is interested in home brewing, it's a book that's going to carry you a long, long way, for sure. And I've got another book coming up to talk about that's going to carry you a long, long way if you're looking for how to solve your dinner issues. And in fact, the book is titled Dinner Solved, 100 Ingenious Recipes That Make the Whole Family Happy, Including You. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.